it took me a long time to be able to even speak out loud what happened. So
yeah,
it's another really important piece in my healing puzzle.
This is Daring to Tell, the podcast where writers read their true stories of personal daring and where we talk about writing and life. I am your host, Michelle Rado.
Nothing's gonna make me brave. Nothing's gonna make me brave. Nothing's gonna make me brave except doing what makes me scared.
Remember the Magic 8 Ball? Man, I loved that. I didn't actually have one, which kind of made it even better, even more magical in my mind. The idea of this mystical medium that could reveal answers to life's many uncertainties. Oh yeah, I loved it. I loved it. My cousins had one, and so when I would visit them, I would want to ask it. I felt a little nervous, even like, what does this thing know that I don't know? Do I have to go to 2 weeks of summer camp? Shake, 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 shake. Don't shake it too much, they would advise me, because the bubbles will make it hard for that little triangular thingy to rise up from the thick turquoisey liquid. Signs point to yes. Ugh, I hated summer camp. I was phobic about bugs, something I am still working on. I was a shy and insecure girl, picked on for being chubby, never picked for sports team lineups until the very end. All right, another question. Will Ronaldo like me? My shyness did not prevent me from having a crush on Ronaldo, who sat behind me in 7th grade social studies. Shake, 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 shake. Reply, hazy. Try again. Ugh, that answer was the worst. Wouldn't you just shake it all over again, demanding a more definitive answer immediately? I did. But like life, the magic eight ball was cagey, often not declaring a clear yes or no. But this leads to my larger point in launching this episode today. Who tells you what to do? Who do you listen to when trying to make decisions? And decisions that are more impactful than whether or not you'll end up going to summer camp or whether your 7th grade crush will end up liking you back. And what happens when the voices and guidance that you have learned to follow lead you to a dead end or down a path so windy and isolated, brambles tangling your footsteps, insects circling your head, that you just can't keep going anymore? Well, you change your mind. That's what Peggy's story is essentially about for anyone who has opted to change their mind about something big in their lives. You may remember Peggy Cook. I spoke with her on the February episode of Daring to Tell when I had just begun working with her on the audiobook of her memoir, Released, Walking from Blame and Shame into Wholeness. It was a conversation that was incredibly dear to my heart as Peggy and I shared growing up in the same religion and also making our way out once we could no longer go on. Now, as of June 4th, 2026, the audiobook of Released has been released into the world, narrated by its author, Peggy Cook. And so let's get to it, shall we? We are here today because today is the release of Released on audiobook. Da, 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 da. I should have put in some kind of little sound effect for us.
Drum roll.
Drum roll. Applause. So, Peggy Cook, how do you feel about your audiobook coming out?
I am excited. I don't exactly know what to expect, but it's a new experience for me.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm always so pleased and excited when any person I've worked with has their pub day. You know, it's a different kind of pub day for the book being available. It's available on Audible. It's available on Libro FM. It will or should be available on, I'll say, Libby or Cloud Library, some of the library ones at your library, whoever you are and where you are, you could ask for it. But it's a very exciting day to have this thing that we've been working on for about 6 months, I would say,
yes,
right?
Yes, yeah. It has been 6 months. Yes.
Did you, I was trying to remember when you first came here. Was it January?
It was January, yes.
Yeah. And so January to June, it's a whole new season, literally.
That's right.
It was, we were trying to walk carefully across
the driveway.
an icy driveway. And now the weeds are growing between the cracks in the driveway.
Yay! Progress around here.
Exactly, exactly. I was listening to the last time we had a conversation together about your book. And before, we talked a lot about what it meant when your book was available as a book and the slow process of writing it, and the fact that it was 5 years between the time when your print book came out and when we started working together, and in your work of promoting the book, which is, you know, not the thing that most writers usually look forward to after the relatively easy job of your blood, sweat, and tears on a page, then promoting it is a whole other layer. But for an audiobook, I guess I was curious to know, looking a little back, because we talked about how we met at one of Nina Lichtenstein's workshops, but when was it that you first had an inkling about possibly wanting to have your book as an audiobook?
It was probably maybe 6 months before we started, or maybe 8 months before we started. I started to think, what else could I do to help my own healing process? Because I was still somewhat in shock that I wrote the book. And when I'd read different chapters every once in a while, I'd be thinking, gosh, was that really me? And I thought, okay, now what could I do to further embody the book? So I started to think about it, and then, but I didn't know who would do that. But then when I heard that Nina was doing it with you, I thought, oh, there's a possibility. And the only one I would do it with, because I wanted someone I would feel safe with, in case all kinds of different emotions came up. Mm-hmm. So I would say probably maybe 8 months.
Wow.
6 to 8 months before.
That's really funny, because that's not really too long before we met. And that is quite serendipitous, because as we talked about the last time, I mean, it's not usual that we stumble across people who have a Christian Science childhood.
Right.
And even with other people who have had other Christian Science childhoods, you know, they all are still distinctive, but I think that we went through some very similar mental absorption of the religion. Yeah.
Or mental, I always think of it as mental gymnastics, you know, trying to have it stick the landing, but it, I couldn't quite.
That's a good. I never stuck that landing either.
No.
But I love what you said about you wanted to embody it, and how healing, that word healing, which still is a sticky one, I think, for both of us, but further becoming more of yourself and developing into your wholer sense of yourself, if that's a word. The embodying it, you know, I mean, I do think that that's what happens when we read our stories out loud, is it becomes embodied somehow. But I just don't know if there's a way that you can describe more about what that desire is, because I love that you said, I still couldn't believe I did it. You know, I still couldn't believe I had written my book. And so it is sort of like, I don't want to say completion, because I don't think that there's ever an end point with a lot of this journey of self-becoming. But it certainly is another layer of whatever the opposite of absorption is, of like ingestion somehow, you know?
Yes.
Taking it into your body in a different way.
And I hadn't been used to even the word embodiment for so long, because that really was not something we wanted to do as Christian Scientists. We wanted to be absent from the body and present with the Lord.
Yeah.
But I was learning about embodiment through my writing process, through my readings, through my therapy. And the first step, of course, was many years before, when I had to, when I really realized that I was a person, which that's a whole nother story. But
we talked about that the first time around too, like being a person. Anyone curious to dive into that, see our prior episode.
Yes. And it's one thing to say, now I'm a person, but it's another thing to really feel that.
Right.
And I knew I was making progress feeling it, but I knew that this book still had some reverberations for me to understand more, for me to really acknowledge the joy and the grief and to feel it. So I just thought, okay, if I read this out loud, I know from reading with my classroom as a teacher, different emotions would come up or enthusiastic responses would come up. And that was half of the joy of reading out loud.
Yeah.
And so I thought, all right, so if I do this, and if I do it with someone I trust, I don't know what will happen, but I know something different will happen than just writing on paper, you know? And it did.
What happened? I mean, I kind of know, but I don't know really.
Yeah. Well, when I started to read it out loud, and I could actually even hear my voice, it was like, oh, okay, this really is my story. This really did happen to me. And there are many complex components to it. I tended to think, oh, yeah, I did that. And then I learned how to walk again. And then I adopted. And yeah, it was an experience. But reading it chapter by chapter by chapter really broke it down, so that even after sessions, when I would go back to the hotel, I'd think, sometimes I would read those chapters again, and it's hard to describe, but I could feel that that had really happened to me, and that I was, okay. Sometimes I used to worry that if I talked about it too much, I'd either lose my composure, which that wouldn't be too bad, but that I'd feel unstable.
Yeah.
Feel like I was having an episode or something.
Yeah, like coming apart, maybe. I don't know.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. Yes. I mean, that's kind of hard to admit, but it's like, yeah. I was afraid I might like rattle apart if I finally got into it.
Yeah.
But we took it so slowly. You were so good about that. Like, we would just take it slowly and break anytime we wanted. And I knew by the end of the first session that this was like going to be a big healing session, healing project. For me.
Yeah. I am so, like, to me, that's icing on the cake, but I mean, that also is cake, you know, because it's so huge. And I love holding a space for the authors that I've worked with. I mean, I especially love holding a space for you, because I can very much relate to what you went through, although I did not have club feet. So that's a different dimension. But still, knowing the mindset of that and vocalizing it, yeah, I can't describe, but I was so happy to have you just come into this space here. And I get really excited when I know you're here to read your story. I have like a hybrid closet studio, and I hope it's comfortable. You know, like I want this, what is created here, to be a safe space for people to come and just go into themselves, because there is something very, like it's the, I feel like it's so intimate, and it's the most intimate thing we can do, to go into this small space by ourselves. You're here with this one ear, you know, this one microphone that you're talking into, which is our listener's ear. And we hear ourselves. We hear those vibrations. I mean, I have started getting so into the concept of vibrations. They're physical things. They are real physical things. And they are doing something in our bodies as we speak this story that we have first lived and then written. And now, again, it's coming out of our mouths. And there's something about it that is transformative. And I don't get it. So that's why I like asking you too. It's like, wow, like we both witnessed that this is what happened, because you got to sit there and read and I got to listen to you do it.
Well, yeah. And I also, I can't underscore how important it was for me when I would look up from the microphone. I could see through the little glass. There's a glass connect, you know, so you can see me and I can see you. That was like, I would look up and think, see, you're not alone. And also somebody is understanding this. They're not, hopefully, not thinking, what is this person talking about? This is, you know, what? So I knew, you know, I knew you understood what I was talking about. And I did start to feel in my body, like you're talking about a little bit, the energy and the rhythm and the, it's almost like a pulsation of like, okay, all right, this happened. What happened next? It's okay. You're all right. You're safe. You can read what happened next. I agree. It did feel alive in a way that the story hadn't before. When I would talk to people in public, the story to me always felt like a really sad story. And people were always a little aghast, you know, and would go, oh, but this wasn't that. This was, let's see if we can understand what happened, if we can understand the thought process about being a Christian Scientist and then unbecoming one.
Yeah, exactly. Because I think it's true, and this I find with many books and audiobooks, because sometimes I read just a book with my eyes and sometimes I just listen to a book with my ears, but sometimes I do both. And in the cases when I've done both, what I find is that the spoken one always has some additional dimension that I didn't get when I was reading it with my eyes. And I think that's a little bit what you're alluding to. It's sort of like when you give someone this very intimate thing to read. I mean, there's uncertainty in life, certainly. Oh, that's a funny thing to say. There's uncertainty in life, period. But when you give someone this book, there it goes. It's for them to read, and they're going to take whatever they're going to take from it. And it is the gift that is now theirs, and they get to have their own reaction and observation and judgment, if there may be, or empathy, if there may be. But with your audiobook, it's almost a little like, wait, but listen to how I'm going to tell you about this. Because now I get to add a little something extra that might not come across on the page. So maybe I would see this as a tad more control over how something would be able to come across. I don't know. Does that ring true?
Yeah, no, that makes sense. I think, too, it was interesting to hear people's reactions, because people who knew the story well and who had read this book were much more affected by the audio reading of our, well, that the podcast that we did. They were like, well, I knew all that happened, but I mean, I never realized or
right.
You know, and some people, some of my friends actually got angry about the way I was raised, the way I was treated, the way, you know, that kind of, and that took me back because it's kind of like I think I'm almost over that. But then people started bringing things up that they never brought up about mm-hmm. reading the book.
Yeah.
So I just feel like when it's your story, of course you can read it with expression, and you can read the parts that maybe were upsetting in a way that brings that across.
Yeah.
More than if you're reading it and you think, oh, this part's really getting too much for me, I'm going to close the book and walk away.
Yeah.
I'll finish this later.
Right, but, right. Yeah.
You know, it's a continuum.
Yeah. So that being said, because I know what you're talking about when people have reactions that can be their indignation about what happened to you, which is very genuine and sincere, but I also relate to shrinking from that a little bit to be like, oh, well, it was okay. You know, I mean, it wasn't okay, but
right.
Oh, I'm better. I'm over it now. But because that's sort of like sloughing off the emotional intensity of what the past was.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
And so, for me,
it was interesting because, well, when I would present this book in public, in my head, I would think, oh, you know, it's just a story. It's over. I'm okay. But when friends expressed their anger or anguish when they heard the podcast, I had to watch that I didn't get triggered and get pulled in back into that chaos of where I was.
Right.
I did talk to my therapist about it because it was like, some words they used, I hadn't used, but they were accurate words like abuse or neglect or whatever. And I was like, wait a minute.
I know.
And then I had to wait, you know, I had to weigh that in my head and weigh what my parents, what their beliefs were, which may seem now like neglect or whatever. But I had to work through that quite a bit.
Yeah. Another thing I was thinking about in working through those things and the paradoxes that exist within this whole business, quote unquote, of writing or of telling our stories. It's not, you know, it's a business, but it's not a business in this whole endeavor.
Mm-hmm.
I'm wondering what you think about how there is just this drive, there's a yearning that begins before the writing process even begins, to put down what happened to me. Like, this is what happened to me. And how that is just unrelenting at times. Because I think if it could relent, we wouldn't end up writing it, you know? We wouldn't do it. Why would we do it if we could put it aside? But also, I've heard you say it more than once, and again, I feel the same way, as a somewhat reclusive or shy person, someone who does not really like to step into the spotlight, it can feel awkward to receive that kind of attention and recognition and even indignant compassion, you know, if you want to call it that way, like this outrage on our behalf of what happened. And yes, as you say, it's accurate, but it's also painful. It's painful to accept it. The question I think I'm driving at is, what do you think the difference is to be heard, to like, in spite of not really wanting to be the person standing up and saying, this is what happened to me, or this is my story, or this is how I was trying to figure out who I am. We still want our story to be heard.
Absolutely. And in writing or in reading it, you want to heal from it, whatever that means. You want to get over the trauma of it.
Mm-hmm.
However, you also want to tell the story
mm-hmm.
to feel validated.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so sometimes it is it can be a very big push pull. I think the more you do it, or the more, like for me, learning about embodiment, the more embodied I feel, I can accept people's love or outrage.
Mm.
When I was struggling to be embodied or to, and for me, embodiment even is like to be present. I used to like to just shift it way back in my mind that this happened. But when you're reading it or writing it, it's present. And it's such a balance between presence, keeping yourself safe, mm-hmm. embodiment. I mean, it's ongoing. It's ongoing for me. It's just,
yeah.
But I feel much more mentally healthy that it's not my little secret. Not that people didn't see me the way I walked, but you know.
No, I know what you mean.
It's not my little secret anymore. I've said it out loud.
Yeah.
It's true. It happened and I can take it. You know what I mean? I'm not going to crumble.
Yeah. I know. When you say that, like, I can take it, it was a secret that was right out in the open. When you were describing that, I was thinking there's a chapter in your book called Under the Rack, and how you crawled under this rack in the, mm-hmm. was it Grant? I picture Grants or some kind of like,
yes,
you know,
W2
store.
Grants.
When your mom was having a conversation with one of your classmates' moms and she had a disability. Did she have cerebral
palsy? She had cerebral palsy.
Yeah. And the other mom confides with your mom about the difficulties of having daughters with disabilities. And it's the secret right out in the open. And poor little Peggy crawls under the rack and
plays with the tags on the jumpers, you know.
I mean, could you ever have fathomed getting out and saying, yeah, mom, look at me?
it would have been so mentally healthy.
Would never have happened in a million years. But that's the thing. And to stand up and say it now, you are standing up for, what were you like, about 10 at that age or something, 12 maybe?
Yes, about 10.
You know, your little 10 or 12-year-old self is saying, yes, this is what I looked like, and it was really sucky.
Exactly. And it was validated, really, when I think back, it was really validated by that very first doctor I went to see.
Yeah.
Because I was sure he'd be disgusted, and instead he was like, this must hurt. How do you do this? Can I call in a colleague to look? What do you do for a living? What do you take for painkillers? Nothing, nothing. How do you, you know, I was supposed to be healing this. So I was not supposed to be talking about it because it wasn't real.
Exactly.
But it felt so good for someone to actually see me.
Yeah, it is a revelation. And they're not like acting like this is some big source of shame.
No,
they're just
no.
like there's a physical compassion that we talked about loving doctors too, that it's just they see you and they want to help the physical problem. And it's not your fault.
That's right. It's not a condition. It's not my value as a person.
Yeah. It's just a revolution and a revelation to have that. Tell me a little bit more about the feeling of embodiment. Like, how did that make itself known to you? Or how did you start feeling it or noticing it? Because to have been in your head and telling yourself to start thinking about being embodied.
Yeah, I mean, it's so far-reaching. I think probably the first time I realized I was embodied was when I woke up from surgery. Because up to that point, every time I walked and it hurt or I did anything and it hurt, I denied it. I said, this is untrue about God's man. When I woke up from the surgery, I was like in mortal anguish. And right away they said, we'll give you more for the pain. Like they were accepting that, you know, pain was real. And it was like, oh, this is new. And And then even the recuperation, when I'd be hooked up to IVs and this and that and the other thing, and I was in traction, I couldn't deny that that was going on. Doctors would come in and say, how do you feel today? Or a nurse would come in and say, I'm going to flush out your IV. And I could feel the IV liquids going up my arm. You know, it was very visceral. And I was still conflicted, like, is this true? Is this error? Is this true? Is this error? But then learning how to walk again, step by step. You don't just wake up and you can walk all of a sudden. You step by step, and the casts have to come off and this and that. So that was the beginning of embodiment, really basically pain embodiment. But then after the pain was pretty much over and I could walk again, I still had to view myself as a human. I had to view myself as being allowed to be seen. That was another little step of embodiment. Mm-hmm. And now embodiment is more like a joyful thing. Like, I can be in the world and be happy. I can be in the world and look at people in the eye.
Yeah.
So it's very incremental.
Yes.
And not done.
Not done. Absolutely. That's so fascinating. And I love hearing about that. And I love, one of the other things I love about people's stories is that incrementalism, you know, that it is such a small thing. And that just because you wake up from surgery and, I mean, you find yourself at the, I'll say at the bottom of a very deep well that you then have to crawl out of. And if you had known what that was going to be like.
Well, one time I went up.
Hate to ask. No, I mean, I obviously, I know the ultimate answer to that, yeah. But still, sometimes ignorance is a good thing, I guess, maybe is what I mean.
Well, yeah. I mean, a year before, when I was looking into surgery, I was friends with the school nurse. I'd go in and talk to her. And I was like, you know, I'm thinking of this. It's orthopedic surgery. Like, how awful will it be? And she was like, oh, I'll never forget it, but it was helpful. She was like, oh, it's bone crunching agony. I thought, wow, huh? And then when I would go to the surgeon ahead of time, all these different meetings, I'd say, you know, like, can you tell me like how much it's going to hurt? And he'd say, there'll be a little discomfort. So I'm actually glad he did that, because
yeah.
It was terrifying enough.
Yeah.
And of course it was worth it. But I really wondered if I'd ever walk again, if I'd ever have the guts to even stand up again. Mm-hmm. But I think having a rational person there, it did help. You know, he didn't say there'll be just some discomfort and you won't need morphine. He said, you know, it'll be uncomfortable, but we'll give you something.
Right, right.
Which didn't take it away. But anyway.
I know. Well,
halfway through the process, before I had the surgery, I knew I was doing the right thing because I really trusted this doctor. He had seen so many people with club feet. And he said to me, if you don't do this, you will be in a wheelchair before long. And I agreed with him because that's what impelled me to do it.
Right.
So wheelchair or pain,
yeah.
Take the pain.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. Well, you know, the last time we had you read for Daring to Tell, but now this is an audiobook launch. So I have a couple chapters lined up to play. How about we go in inverse order? Because we're talking about coming out of surgery. So I was thinking we could play The Fog.
Oh, yeah.
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 That's a great chapter. Okay. So now we will hear a little bit from Peggy Cook's audiobook called Released. And this is a chapter called
The Fog. The task which her own mother may have failed to perform, she must perform. Marion Woodman. I am trapped in a white fog, a swirling mist of echoing beeps, eyes shut. Are you awake? Peggy, it's all done.
We called your brother, and he knows. He's coming to see you later. Uh-huh. Is there a ship on my leg? It's so heavy, and it's killing me. A ship on your leg? I'll give you more medicine for the pain. There's no ship. Take deep breaths through the mask. What time is it? It's 6 o'clock. The surgery started at 10. The whole day is gone. I can't move. I don't want to move. I want to go home. I made a terrible mistake. It's too late now. Now I've done it. Nurses swarm around me. I'm freezing. The monitors beep. Dr. Zimbler wants an x-ray. Now? His voice is behind me. A massive machine looms over me. A plate slides under the cast. No, no, don't touch me. The x-ray is done. Dr. Zimbler likes how it looks. I hurt. I'm scared I'll lie like this forever. The surgical nurse asks, are you okay? I'm not okay. I am trained to say I am okay. I am not okay. This pain will kill me. I cannot live like this. This was a huge mistake. Now I know. From the waist down, my body is on fire. Dr. Zimbler warned me about discomfort. He didn't say agony. Why isn't the pain medication working? Male orderlies roll my bed towards an elevator. They speak gently. I moan. The elevator is huge. It looks like a freight elevator. I'm surrounded. I look around. I close my eyes. Where are we? Don't let the bed bump. It bumps over the lip of the elevator. I feel it. Don't touch me. Rows of light shine above me. We're not in the recovery room anymore. We're in the hall of the orthopedic floor. The doors swing open. The lights are too bright. Someone is yelling, help me, please. They sound desperate. The nurse says the yeller just had her hip replaced. I'm in my room on 3 West. I'm rolled next to a window. The nurse in my room asks, how are you? Fine. I'm not fine. I am not fine. I don't know what all this equipment is. It's done for today, a nurse says. Your left foot is done. A technician comes to set up traction. He is quiet. I'm glad. Don't talk to me. There are weights clanging on the side of the bed. Be careful. Don't touch me. I'll need to lift up your leg for a moment. Be careful, okay? The leg is wrapped in a soft cast up to my thigh. The cast is far away from my eyes. Does my foot look straight? David will know. I have to remember to ask. I'm so scared. I hope I can do this. I can do this. I'm not sure I can do this. David is looking at me. He has a suit on. I try not to cry. Is my foot straight? Is it at a 90-degree angle? He says it is. Are you sure? Then it's worth it. I'm flat on my back with no way out. Someone comes in and puts an IV in my right top wrist. It's for fluids, she says. She tapes the tube down. There is too much stuff on me. David keeps looking at me. Are you okay? Are you sure? I will be back tomorrow. We are worried about you. It took 8 hours. That is really long. Tell Linda I'm okay. I'm not okay. I'm sure I'm not okay. She will want to know that I am. David is gone. I hope he comes back. Dr. Zimbler comes in and asks how I'm doing. I say fine. I am not fine. I am nauseous. What if I throw up? My body feels heavy and useless. It's still so foggy. Nurses come in and out and adjust the bed, the pillows, and the rail. The blood pressure cuff feels too tight. Machines beep. The nurses are very calm and move fast. Dr. Zimbler says he did everything he wanted with the left foot and leg. He still has his green scrubs on. The right foot surgery is Monday. There's blood on his scrubs, my blood. He looks so different in scrubs. He has muscles and green slippers on his shoes. He pats my arm. He says I did well. I think that means he's proud of me for not losing too much blood. I feel like the good student. He will come back tomorrow. I hope he does. I feel safe with him in the room. The soft cast is just temporary to let the leg swell. Okay, thank you so much. What have I done? What if I never stand again? The room is dark for a few minutes. The TV is off. There's a window to my right. Someone is at the foot of my bed. I squint to see who it is. It was Jean. She used to be a good friend of mine. She had an uncorrected cleft palate. Her speech was distinctive. That's how I knew it was Jean. She was a Christian Science practitioner. She prayed for our family. She and I used to have an appointment every Saturday. I talked to her about my mom's cancer. She tried to help me not be scared, but I was scared. I was very scared. We talked about God and healing. But Mom died. We're not such good friends lately. I disappointed her when I said I was going to have surgery. I told her it's not too late for her either. She didn't like that. So I walked out of her office. She cried. I'm not sure why. Peggy. Yeah, it really hurts. It really hurts. She tells me that's because I've turned away from God. Turned away and didn't trust. Get out of my room and don't come again. I'm shocked I can talk that loud. Jean walks out. Who invited her to come? What does she know? She knows a lot. She knows what it's like to be different. She knows what it's like to be stared at the minute she talks. How does she have faith to go on? Well, I don't. I can't believe I did this. I hope I didn't make a big mistake. Someone comes in and wants me to blow in a tube. I can hardly do it. It tastes funny. She tells me to try again. She doesn't want me to get pneumonia from the anesthesia. I blow some more. She says she'll be back tomorrow to do it again. Everybody is coming back tomorrow. A nurse tries to spoon red jello into my mouth. I don't want it. She says I need to swallow so I can pee. There is so much to do. I just want to moan all by myself. No jello. It's almost time for my morphine, I hope. The nurse lifts up the sheet and injects me in my bottom. I don't care if it hurts. It doesn't work enough. I thought painkillers kill pain. They don't. Linda pokes her head in. She asks how I am. Fine. I am not fine. She sits on a chair across from me. David is home with the kids. She does not say anything about God. That is nice of her. A nurse wants me to try to pee again. It's hard not to cry. I can't pee on command. The nurse turns on the water in the little sink to see if it will help. It does not. It is important, she says. I would if I could. If I can't, I will need to be catheterized. That does not sound fun. But I can't pee. Linda leaves. She'll be back another day. Okay. Thanks for everything. The words come out slowly. She's so lucky she can go home. Finally, I close my eyes. The nurse keeps checking my vitals. I learn what vitals are. Another nurse adds a second IV to make sure there's no infection. Now I have two in one arm. I cannot get comfortable. I feel the cold liquid going up my vein. Is this normal? I can't change positions. I hurt too much to sleep. The nurse asks me to pee on the bedpan. Still no go. She leaves it on the side table. She sends for a nurse to catheterize me. I don't care. Just do it. A male nurse comes in. I don't care that he's a male. He's so gentle, and it's done fast. I don't need to worry about that anymore. I have tubes going in and out of me. Every function is monitored. Numbers flash on screens.
Wow.
Yeah, I wanted to stay catheterized forever. That was so easy. I was so scared. It was like, that was easy. Keep
That's
up the good work.
Exactly what I thought when I was catheterized. Except they did it while I was out. And I was like, wow, this is nice. Like, just equilibrium forever. Never have to worry about going to the bathroom.
I know. When they came to take it out, I was like, are you sure?
I know.
Okay.
Do you have to? I can't imagine any other people on the face of the earth saying those things. Oh, my God. How is it hearing it? I have so much I could say, but I want to hear what you have to say.
Ah, oh, it's like a trip down memory lane. Just the shock.
Oh, my God.
I'll never get over the shock of pain medication not taking away the pain.
Yeah.
That just shows how innocent I was. You know, I had never had anything, you know, big done like this. And it was just like, whoa, this isn't good.
I know. I mean, like, there's a ship on my leg. What is this ship doing on my leg?
And it really felt like it. It was like a tanker, you know, it was, but anyway.
Yeah.
I mean, in some ways, when I hear the story or read the story, I'm always just a tad proud that I actually did that. And boy, was I lucky that it turned out the way it did.
Oh, I know.
You know?
I mean, that's the other thing is we go, it didn't have to be that way.
Yeah.
And that's, talk about gratitude. Like, that is gratitude.
Absolutely.
That it turned out as well as it did. That is just huge, huge. I can't even begin listing all the things I love about this chapter. You know, we discussed, well, maybe we didn't discuss. I had this vision for how to try and bring an aural, A-U-R, I don't know how you spell the word. How do you bring a sound element to this chapter that has a lot of italic texts, which is your internal dialogue with your other internal dialogue? It's sort of, you know, plus all these people coming in and out of your room. So it was many layers of voices going on. And I really wanted to recognize those italics and in some audio way. And I have to give a huge shout out to my sound and mastering engineer, Marcus DePaula, who took a very rudimentary incarnation to sort of put a sound to that internal voice. Mm-hmm. And he created that much more eerie sort of like, what space am I in kind of sound. Mm-hmm. And, and that's just for the record, that's the only chapter that has any kind of like varied sound within it. You know, mm-hmm. It wasn't going to be like a huge feature of the book, but I felt like this served the text to do something mm-hmm. in that way. Mm-hmm. But there's just so much in your voice that I love through this chapter. When you said to Jean about correcting her cleft palate, and you said she didn't like that. I mean, we laugh. I think this nervous sort of like expunging of energy, I mean, this is brutal stuff. But how do you stand up and say the emperor has no clothes? You know, I mean, that is the thing that is sort of going on with calling out what we see is happening and what we can tolerate, frankly. I mean, and I really want to be sensitive to people's spiritual beliefs, to their religious practices, what they do and don't do. I mean, every person does what they can do. And I do respect that very much. But when what they think they are adhering to for themselves is something that I need to adhere to as well, when that's not my experience now or maybe anymore, well, then it's like standing up and saying so is obviously the challenge throughout this whole book. But hearing it in your voice is really what I love in this chapter. And hearing the part about the catheter and not going to be fun. And it's like, I mean, the things that we think, that sounds terrible. And you go, oh, all right. Well, I mean, I'm sure it wasn't fun, you know, but relatively speaking at that moment, I mean, I think that's why we can laugh at this thing too.
Well, compared to some other
things. Compared to a ship on your leg, a catheter.
It was pretty easy.
Walk in the park.
Yeah. And I think, you know, when I think back on when I said to her, you know, you could have it done, practically the minute I told her what I was going to do. I mean, I think we were, the both of us were caught off guard. I mean, I never was that absolute about something. So for me to say, I'm having surgery and I walk out
was a big,
I mean,
deal.
I'm sure that took her by surprise. Yeah. I think we used to be, in a way, kindred spirits, even though we were supposed to be denying the physical deformities.
Yeah. Right.
And like you say, I have become a little more compassionate in that, you know, she radically relied on Christian Science. It worked for her. It didn't work for her in getting a healing, but it worked for her in having a full life, in having a beautiful family, in being a practitioner, which now, of course, I wouldn't go to. But, you know, I mean, like you say, everybody makes those choices. Mm-hmm. And it's just the way it is. And sometimes the two parties conflict.
Yeah.
Like, if she hadn't come to the hospital room and said that, I probably maybe would have still been friends with her. But I try to give her a little grace in that that came out so naturally. That's what she thought. And it was like fair warning. Well, now you've been warned. This is what happens. Well, I didn't take that warning, and that's okay.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's just very, very human emotions. And physical disabilities are very fraught.
Yeah. And the thing that really stuck out to me is that every single person that walked in your room, from David, your brother, we hadn't mentioned, and his wife, Linda, the nurses, doctors, how are you? Fine. How are you? Fine. I'm fine. I'm not fine. And then we get the intern voice. I'm not fine, but I know I'm supposed to say I'm fine and I'm fine. And then she comes in and here is your confidant, you know, your practitioner, your close confidant, your kindred spirit. And you open up your heart in that moment. You know, it hurts. It really hurts. And that was met with something that was not able to be heard. You know, she couldn't.
Yes.
She had to tell you why it hurt. And that hurt even, you know. Let's just keep passing this hurt back and forth because,
Well, and it, I mean, I'm not a therapist, but if she said, wow, this was a great idea. This is fabulous. You're looking, you know.
I know.
What did it say about what she was following?
Well, that's a toughie. And,
And my father was like that too, really. I mean, the night before I had it done, I called. I didn't say it hurt because I hadn't had it done yet.
Yeah.
But he was like, this is a very dangerous thing you're doing. I hope you know what you're doing. This is very dangerous.
Wow.
We didn't do it because it was so, well, you know, but Dr. Zimbler had already told me, which I didn't say to him, that no, it's not dangerous.
Right.
Even when I was a baby, it wasn't dangerous. So I didn't have to worry about that.
Right.
You know, I would be able to walk again.
Yeah. Yeah.
So,
and you had the trust.
Yes.
That was a reliable.
He was a reliable source.
Yeah. Yeah.
The doctor.
Yeah. Exactly. We have another chapter that is another one that I love your voice in. Now, we're going to go backwards if you're okay with me playing this one, too. It's a little shorter. It's earlier. So in the prior podcast episode, also, we heard more of the daughter. We heard from the childhood and the daughter. But I wanted to hear from the patient because this is another huge facet of your story. And this, the fog is just the beginning. Like, once the fog clears, there's a whole other journey that takes place. But before that, and to this subject of our vibrations and our bodies, this is something, another reason why I love memoir read by the author, because this is something only you could represent what you were going through during this moment. So we're going to now hear a chapter called
Peggy's Having Trouble. Don't tell me what I'm feeling. You can die more than once in your life, you know. James Hillman. I pull my blankets right up to my chin. I reposition Gray Kitty to make sure she's right under my left armpit, as close as she can get. I feel her woolly warmth, and I finger her smooth glass eyes. The door shuts tight, the room black, the cloth window shades down. The windows are open, a crack for air. David lies in bed way across the room. He might be asleep already. I hunker down as close to the wall as I can with Kitty. Then I wake with a start. My panic comes from somewhere familiar. Do I see shadows on the wall, even with the shades down? Do I hear the fire horn blaring its cry for the engines to come quickly? Is the fire near us? I have to go to the bathroom, I sing out across the dark room. I have to go to the bathroom. My notes become higher, the words faster, as no one responds. I have to go to the bathroom. My voice is shrill, hoping someone saves me. David lends his voice. Peggy's having trouble. Slowly, calmly. One more time, a bit louder. Peggy's having trouble. Finally, the door opens. I see a crack of light from the hall. In the corner of my twin bed, I still clutch Kitty. She has no tail. I'm so close to the wall, I might fall through to the floor. Mom whispers, God is with you. She is standing next to the side of my bed. I recognize her bathrobe smell of baby powder. How does she know I don't need to go to the bathroom? Why doesn't she offer to take me downstairs? How does she know I'm not having trouble? There's plenty of room in my twin bed for her to come lie down with me. She keeps standing over me. I wish her hands would reach out to pick me up. I don't weigh too much. I'm just 3 years old. But she keeps standing over me. Lie down with me. Lie down with me, I pray. She knows me well. She knows I don't have to go to the bathroom. David and I know how to send secret coded messages. We know their meanings. Peggy seems scared to death again about something and needs you. Mom knows I only need God. So she tells me God is always with me. Kitty feels lumpy under my armpit. Mom walks out of the vast bedroom in her pink bathrobe and beaded slippers. She thinks all is well. That's why Dad doesn't come in. He knows God's care for me is ever present. But I'm still scared.
Another breathtaking. Oh, my Peggy, little 3-year-old Peggy, my heart goes out to you.
Well, it's just a little example of how neurotic I was, and also how I already knew already at age 3.
Yeah.
I was not allowed to really say what was wrong. And even David, who said Peggy's having trouble, even he had learned not to say what was wrong.
Yeah.
Like, he knew I was scared. So when I wrote that, at first I kind of wrote it as a joke, because sometimes, well, the idea of it was a joke, because sometimes my brother and I will, now that we're all grown up, will laugh and say, you know, Peggy's having trouble, or somebody's right. Scared, I have to go to the bathroom, you know, and then we go, ha, ha, ha.
Right.
But it would have been nice to learn how to say what you really feel. And I know it was the 50s, but it did inform my parenting in that when somebody called out, I went, and well, they already knew not to just pretend, but you know, I would get in bed with them, or I would hold them, or I would do something. And so, yeah, it was a lesson in how to be honest, I guess.
Yeah, how to be emotionally honest and emotionally responsive too, because you shared a lot with us about your mom and later stages of your mom. It's just so difficult when there is this, I'll say, prayer in response to a physical or an emotional deficit. And it's not that someone doesn't care, and it's not that they don't feel that they're doing something for you, but there's also the vast gap between physical comfort or emotional comfort or knowing how you can have your needs attended to, you know, or not. And the writing in both of these chapters is so immediate. Like, you really paint. I can picture you in your little bed with your gray kitty under your armpit. And, you know, I could see the hospital room that you were in. I mean, you either have a phenomenal memory or you were able to sort of repopulate those places. I mean, your childhood bedroom is one thing. A hospital room is, you know, rather standard, but
both are something you'll never forget.
That's
both
true.
Are places you'll never forget.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I tended to be, I'm not discounting my emotional self, but I tended to be the barometer of something. And so
say more about that. What do you mean?
Well, I tended to always know when somebody was coming home in a bad mood. They didn't have to say anything. I just knew. Or if somebody was upset, I just could feel it. It wasn't really a comfortable feeling to have growing up, because I was always like, I guess, fight or flight type thing.
Right.
And that scene in that bedroom a couple months before, there had been a very big fire across the street and up a little bit. And the flames were on the wall, and a woman died in that fire, and she had cows, and they died, and you could hear the cows mooing.
Oh, my God.
Not that night, but I'm just saying that had happened.
Right. Well, that's why the sirens were a...
Yes. And that night, my parents both ran in, and we lifted up the shades, and we could see what was going on. But anyway, so I'm sure I saw some little something on the wall, and it was like, ma...
Right.
But it helps. I don't know. It just helps to be human.
Oh, man. Truer words have never been spoken. It helps to be human. Absolutely. What are your hopes for this audiobook?
Well, I'm learning about audiobooks myself, so I want to learn more about how it all works. But also, if somebody happens to find it and wants to listen, I'm always hoping that there'll be some medicine, some healing medicine for that person. If they're struggling with something, or if they're struggling with their family, or if they haven't felt human, or, you know, whatever. So I guess it's kind of like with the book, you know, you hope that you're reaching someone.
Yeah.
And this will further enhance, you know, being able to reach people, I hope.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, this is not the end of any road, Peggy, for you
it's
and
the
me
end of the road.
In this book. I mean, I really am hoping that people are going to really be benefited and drawn in by your story, because it's a remarkable story. And I'm so proud of you. And I'm so proud of working together with you on the audiobook.
Yeah, it wouldn't have happened without you. So
it's hard to take that in. It's hard. I want to
try.
Well,
it's true.
Yeah.
It's very true. Maybe other people who do audiobooks are not like this, but it took me a long time to be able to even speak out loud what happened. So
yeah.
it's another really important piece in my healing puzzle.
Yeah. I mean, I think that, I think for everyone recording their own story, there does need to be a sense of a safe place to be able to really embody your book, embody your words with how you have to communicate them. To be able to do that and move through it, it's another layer, another dimension. And I am so honored to have been able to hold that space for you and to do that here.
Well, I feel like we become friends for life doing it too, because our stories are, it helps to have a parallel listener, somebody through that glass who knows what it's all about. I think it helped me.
And it helped me, it helped me to be your witness, like going back to that being seen thing or being heard. I think the stage for me that I feel simpatico with you about is the embodiment of, like, I don't have to do it your way. If I have something to do and I have something to say, thank you very much for your offer of this other thing, whatever it is. But I get to have my own way and I get to have my say over how to do it too.
Yes, and it's a risk. And for me, I also had to be ready to fail. Like if this didn't work and who knows what, but I had to be ready to take the chance. And I think it's just such a part of growing up. I mean, I had always trusted other people to tell me what to think and what to do.
Yeah.
So it was a real growing experience. And I think the other thing I wanted to say is when we would take breaks, it was so helpful to come back to the present reality. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, we would stop for a short lunch or we would stop and discuss something. It was good to come back to that reality and see, oh, yes, I'm still in one piece. Yes, it worked. My feet are facing straight.
Yeah.
Yeah, this was worth it.
Yeah, it was a trip. It was
it was a trip.
I didn't mean it that way, but
it was.
It's a trip to go back in and out of your own life and safely step on the ledge of right now.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Because when I went back to the hotel at night, I never felt like I was flipping out. Mm. I felt calm. So that told me something too, that this was a good venture and also that I was ready, that I was ready to do it.
Yeah.
So.
Absolutely. Oh, my dear. Well.
So that's it.
That's it. Peggy Cook's book, Released, is now available wherever you get your audiobooks, at Audible or Libro FM, which, if people don't know about Libro FM, it's an app that you can get and download on your phone. And I think of it as the audiobook equivalent to bookshop.org, where you can choose an affiliate independent bookstore for a portion of the proceeds to benefit. So you can do the same thing with Libro FM. It's an independent audiobook seller. You can do the same thing like people may be familiar with Audible, where you can have a membership and get a credit monthly to download whatever audiobook you want to check out next. Or you can buy them one off. You can request them from a library, as I was mentioning before. But it is available. It is out there. It is a beautiful book that I am entirely proud of and so honored to have been the midwife for, I guess, of putting the book out into the world. Peggy, we'll figure something out next. I feel like I want to. Well, I have some other ideas cooking for promoting the audiobook beyond this, but maybe we would do a talk somewhere together. What do you think about that?
Wow.
I'm going to throw that in at the end.
That's all I'll say is wow.
Wow. Maybe.
Anything you suggest, I do consider.
I love that. Please don't say yes right away. Just consider. And we all, everyone will consider things, what might be right. Anything else you want to say before we wrap up today?
The only thing I would say is, if I get any proceeds from this, they are all being given to an organization called Clubfoot Solutions.
Oh.
And that's what I did with my print book.
Oh.
And it's an organization in Iowa where the Ponseti Method started, which is a way to treat club feet in infants. And this money goes to third world country doctors who want to do clubfoot surgery, but they don't have the money to have the braces and some of the materials. And so this goes to them, and they're reputable. And it's just nice. Like on Facebook, sometimes I'll see, they call it the clubfoot cutie of the week. And it's like the person who got surgery from in a third world country. So anyway, I just wanted to put that in.
That is wonderful. Thank you so much for sharing that. I love knowing that. That is really important. Say the name of the organization one more time.
It's called Clubfoot Solutions. You can Google it if you want.
Yeah.
And it's out of Iowa.
Excellent. Oh, well, all the more reason to go download the book right now. Or make an independent contribution. That's great. All right, Peggy, thank you so much. I'll be chatting with you some other time. We'll see.
All right. Thank you.
Peggy and I are indeed cooking up an event to take place sometime later this summer, maybe August, maybe September. We don't exactly know when yet. But if you would like to be in the loop for when that does happen, please sign up for my newsletter. It is called The Redo. You can sign up for it at my website, michellerado.com. My newsletter is the place where I mull over questions that inevitably pop up after my guest and I turn off our microphones. For this one, gosh, I realized I didn't ask Peggy anything about what her dad's reaction was after she had had her surgery. I can't believe that it didn't occur to me. And that kind of brings me back to my thoughts about questions and even going back to thinking about the magic eight ball. What I recognize now, looking back when I was wanting to play with this little toy, I wanted to believe that this thing held power to see into me and my desires. What that deeper desire was the fact that I had questions. Even then, I had questions about what makes the world tick, questions about myself, my body, what was real, what was error, questions that my religion just didn't seem to really satisfy for me. The answers that I got often led back to simply God and all goodness is the only thing that was real. And that didn't really represent my experience, so I kind of learned not to ask questions. I think Peggy would probably agree with this as a tendency that was implanted into us. One way I've learned how to give myself the permission to start asking questions, well, a microphone. If I have this microphone in front of me, it's my physical permission slip. I try to be kind, I try to be respectful, but I try to learn now how to ask. All right, well, I think that's probably enough pontificating. There is a link in the show notes for an audiobook purchase of Released, Walking from Blame and Shame into Wholeness, a link to Peggy's website where you can read more about her, and a link to Clubfoot Solutions that she mentioned that will be receiving proceeds from the sale of her book. So lots of good being spread around with doing that. I am going to leave you with a song from the music division of Flying Pig Audio, and that is my husband Phil Rado, because of how well it lines up with something that Peggy had spoken of, and that is the quiet surprise and delight we can find when we do step out of our comfort zone and discover that we don't fall apart. Thank you, Peggy. Thank you, Phil Rado. Thank you, Marcus DePaula. But most of all, thank you for daring to listen. I will catch you next time.
I won't break. I won't break. I won't break. I tell you why. I'm as bland as a butterfly. I won't break. I tell you why. I'm as true. I know.